All right, so welcome. So this is the last talk in this month-long series on the Satipatthana Sutta, also called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Now this month I've been looking at it from a particular lens or approach, and that is of looking at the sutta as a way to help us deconstruct this sense of self, to deconstruct this sense of self. And sometimes it's helpful to look at a sutta from a particular lens, you know, from the deepest understanding that you have, to see, okay, how does this sutta really bring that forth? How does it help inform my wisdom? So the sense of deconstruction of self is a very critical part in our practice. In some ways you could say, you could argue it's the most critical. Because when we start to understand the sense of self and how we form it and how we identify it, we're at the same time understanding how we create suffering in our lives, how we create unnecessary angst and difficulty through this sense of identification. Okay, so this Satipatthana, or Four Foundations, goes through these different elements of our experience as a human being, almost systematically looking at the body, looking at our reactivity, looking at our minds, and seeing how this itself isn't a lasting sense of self. We form the sense of self from that. We identify, this is who I am, but yet it changes. So when it changes, we realize we can't, putting our investment in it being always the same will have a quality of suffering, a quality of difficulty with that. And particularly this sutta looks at this practice of mindfulness. So this is the key sutta in how to practice mindfulness. How do we apply it in different ways, in different areas of our experience? In particular, there's this quality of steady attention, but also attention that's very non-preferential. It doesn't judge or want it to be this way or not. So it's we have to interrupt this normal judging quality of our mind to really to experience in a very innocent way, a very fresh way, to allow it to be just as it is. Okay, this, we're talking about this moment's experience, how this moment is arising, right? Often our mind goes into, what about all these issues in my life, all these problems in my life? For right now, let's just look at it from this lens of how do we relate to this very moment's experience? And I think you find as that transforms, the problems of your life start to transform. So this sutta, just to quickly review these other 3 weeks, we started off by looking at the first foundation of the body and the breath. We first arrive into the body, and this is a big step, because usually we're so caught in the conceptual, the abstract, the world of thought, and to actually inhabit this body, to actually feel what our breath feels like in this moment, what is our contact on the feet, on the cushion, on the chair. What actually is that contact? What does it actually feel like? Not the thoughts of it, but the actual experience of it is a huge step. Once we start to arrive in the body, start to ground in this present moment, we expand to just knowing it very simply, not having a sense of the breath needs to be this way or that way, the body has to be a certain way, but just simply to know it, just as it is. This becomes a template that we see all the way through the Satipatthana Sutta. Knowing the breath just as it is, the posture just as it is, the movement of the body just as it is. And then the Buddha starts to take us through, once we've arrived, to start to deconstruct the layers of identity we put over the body. And we just reflect for a moment how you view your body. You know, you like parts of it, you don't like other parts. Those are all ways we identify with the body. So the Buddha takes apart the different aspects that the body's not a whole. There's actually all these little aspects that we put together as a whole entity. That starts to loosen this identification that my body is attractive, my body is unattractive. Then we start to look at the body from an experiential level, below the level of concept, to the actual sense of pressure in the body, of warmth, of coolness, of flow. This is the elemental practice. And then finally seeing that the body, no matter how we hold it, will eventually die and decay and disintegrate. And so when we take that in, it also starts to loosen this sense of my body is something solid. I realize that it's not lasting forever. So all this process of deconstructing our identification with the self through the body. And then we go on to feeling tone or vedana. We can think of it simply as this reactivity that we have to life, that we're irritated, we're angry, or we want something, we're really desiring something, a sense of being spaced out. So this, the vedana, the feeling tone, becomes the seed that we build this whole level of reactivity, which we really identify with. When we start to observe it simply, there's something magical about starting to loosen this quality of identification, because if we're able to see it and observe it, we're not within it. You know, we're not within what we can observe. And then the third foundation is of mind states. Now these ones we take even more personally. We even more cherish. These are aspects of who we take ourselves to be. Who we take ourselves to be is really found in our mind states. You know, I'm angry right now, I'm sad right now, I'm fearful, I'm happy. Right? We take these as being a sense of who we are. Okay, how are you feeling? I'm feeling this way. Right? So we observe that. Without this preferential, this being sadness is better than anger, joy is better than fear, just noticing just how it is. And the Buddha takes it one step forward or further, which is, I think, is really instructive in our practice, into our world as a meditator. You know, as a meditator, we think, okay, I'm trying to get away from all these mind states, this being human, all right? So I want to go into this sense of being very concentrated or very still or different, more mystical states, being very calm. And the Buddha said, just to notice, are you calm? Is the mind state calm or not calm? Is it concentrated or not concentrated? With absolutely no value judgment at one being better than another. Because when we put a sense of one being better than another, we've positioned ourselves. We've created a sense of self in relationship to what is being observed. What is being observed, when it's judged as good or bad, we've automatically created a sense of self. By learning to observe without putting that layer over it, we start to loosen that quality of selfing that's inherent in judging as good or bad. Okay, so that's the first three foundations. So where's the Buddha go? Where's the sutta go to finish in the fourth foundation? So, you know, the instructions that we've established over these weeks in the first three foundations, to just know what's arising, what's present, without a sense of judgment, a sense of preference, just to clearly know it. It can be helpful to expand that with a sense of compassion, a sense of open-heartedness to this moment's experience. So the meditation feels very intimate, doesn't feel aloof. Right? So these are really established in these first foundations. And so in this foundation, we apply it to what the Buddha called, or has been translated as, mental qualities or mental objects, or also dharmas. We'll get into that in a couple minutes here. But this foundation also adds two new elements that I think are important to explore and to really be clear about. One is knowing, not only knowing what's present, but also noticing the rising of it and the falling away of it, the fading of it, the origination of it, and the dissolving of that experience. This is actually featured in the chorus of the refrain throughout the sutta, but it comes to and really into the body of the sutta in this foundation. Now, this arising and fading sometimes can seem a little esoteric, but in the meditation instructions that you learn early on, we're just learning how to connect with our breath. The breath rises. You notice when the breath in-breath stops and the out-breath begins. You notice the sensation that arises. It lasts for a while and then it fades. So it's a very direct experiential knowing of this that we see in our bodies. We also see it when we introduce thought as an object to meditation. That often when I instruct people to start to notice when thoughts are rising, it's like these soap bubbles that are rising. And as soon as they pay their attention to it, it pops. Because thought has this ephemeral quality to it. other thoughts are more sticky, have more density to it. But eventually, as our meditation becomes more relaxed and alert, we start to see the very arising of a thought and the very fading of that thought. And even further, we can start to see what perhaps triggered that thought. You know, hearing a sound, and there's this whole thought stream that arises from that. Right? So this arising and passing away isn't a foreign thing to you. Just to translate what you've learned in the meditation into the dharmas, into these mind qualities that we'll explore in a minute. It's simply like sitting in the middle of this room. If you sit with a soft gaze, you can see if someone, you know, scratches their head or gets up and leaves or comes into the room, adjusts their posture. That's a quality of sitting in the middle of your experience, feeling open to all your senses. Something arises and it passes away. So there's a quality of being still in the middle of that. It's easy to observe it. If our meditation is very focused, we often don't see other than what we're looking at. So particularly in this tradition, we start to move more and more to this open field of awareness, seeing things as they arise and pass away without preference. So this arising and fading is an important aspect to this, addition to this foundation. The other one I want to talk about is looking at experience through Dharma concepts, through the Dharma concepts. So into this point, the Buddha has been very just noticing what's here. Notice if the mind's this way or that way. Notice if the Veda is this way or that way. Notice if the body is this way or that way, without making any sense of story or idea around it. By doing that, we start to really clean up our natural tendency to evaluate, to judge, to make a preference. So we start to develop this capacity of mindfulness to see things very simply. Now, once that gets established in us, then we can start to notice, as things arise, start to see in the context of the Dharma. This is one of the big pieces of this foundation. So for example, let's say I'm feeling irritated. Okay, so there's feeling that in the body, the sense in the body, knowing it as unpleasant Vedana. This last week I talked about that little piece of dust that creates this big ice crystal that forms. That's the little bit of Vedana. And then being pleasant or unpleasant. From the unpleasantness, I form a thought around it. I start to form a sense of me around that. Okay, so this formation of self. So I'm feeling angry, I notice the Vedana, I notice that it's unpleasant. I notice the mind state of anger. And now in this week, we start to notice, okay, this also recognize this moment as a moment of aversion from the hindrances. Okay? So by pulling up these Dharma concepts, it is, yes, using thought again, bringing thought back in, but it's using it with this embedded with our wisdom that we've developed through our direct experience. It's really, this is a very experiential practice. And that's why the dharmas are left to the end. So it's not a sense of list that we try to, okay, I know this one and this one and this one. It's really seeing it experientially. Oh, this moment is filled with aversion. This is filled with restlessness and sleepiness. Wherever is arising in the moment, I have this context of it. So it helps us place the experience within the Dharma framework. Again, we have to be careful to bring in this deconstruction of self as the surface of that. So we don't construct the sense of self with, okay, I got this whole framework laid out. Now this sutta has a lot, this foundation has a lot of detail. There's the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, seven factors of awakening, and four noble truths. So that's 27 things. Okay, so I was thinking, well, if I cover, from 45 minutes, if I cover each one in a minute and a half, I have a little time for conclusion and introduction. All right, so instead of doing it that way, we're going to reduce it. We're going to make it a little simpler. And as you go through these, one of the beauties of the sutta is that these lists, these common lists that we mostly know, hindrances, aggregates, self-sense bases, seven factors awakening, four noble truths, we often approach them as something I want to learn. I want to obtain that as knowledge. In the sutta, he's encouraging us to actually make them into practices which are available in this very moment's arising. In this very moment, how can we see that there's this moment of mindfulness, of investigation, of aversion? So let's reduce it into three areas, that 27 things. So one is this movement toward contraction or toward release. Movement toward contraction or release. The mechanism, the next one is the mechanism of forming the sense of self. Right? So, and then also the Four Noble Truths. So let's explore these three areas a little more in detail. So the first one is this movement of contraction, the movement of release. You know, what contracts, noticing what contracts, what causes the contraction, the closing, the tightening, and also noticing what causes this opening, the sense of releasing. So the hindrances and the awakening factors we can put into this category. I really like this pairing, this combination, putting these together, this juxtaposition of these two opposites. Because we think of the hindrances as something that's really stopping us from practicing, is one attitude we have toward them. We look at the awakening practice, seven factors of awakening, as a way to deepen into our practice. I mean, the way they're labeled, hindrance versus awakening, there's kind of a bias in there. But this juxtaposition in the sutta and in our practice really helps to flesh things out. Because one, looking at what contracts us is very helpful. Looking at what opens us is also very helpful. If we just look at one or the other, there's a bit of a distortion that we can slip in. To give an example of that, from my past, I used to be a swimmer in high school. One of my swim coaches, he did an event called the IM, the medley. So four different events, strokes in one thing, in one race. And he would always look at which was his worst. Which of these four was he the worst at? And so then he would focus a lot on that. He would focus for the next 6 months, making that the strongest one. And he would look again and say, okay, which is the worst now? And he would keep going through this process to help him excel more and more. On the other hand, one of my mentors in my professional life, he said, it's better to focus on what you do well. And we spend so much of our time trying to fix the 10%, which isn't working. It's better to look at the 90%, which is working, and make that so much better that it fills up the 100%. And so these two sides of it, looking at what's not working and trying to fix it, looking at what's working well and deepening into that. So in spiritual practice, it's very helpful to bring attention to both qualities, what causes our hearts to close, our hearts to tighten, a sense of selfing that comes up, to really deeply understand that so we're no longer driven by it. At the same time, it's very helpful to notice what causes the release, the letting go of the tightening. What is the opening? So the five hindrances often are seen as this quality of contraction, of tightening, patterns of reactivity, fatigue, overwhelm, uncertainty. And in the sutta, the Buddha talks about simply noticing when they're present. Okay, so that should sound very familiar. Noticing there's aversion, there's restlessness and worry, there's sloth and torpor. This is what's present in my experience in this moment. Noticing when it's not present. Ah, this is a moment of non-sleepiness, of non-aversion, of non-craving. And the third part that's added in this foundation is noticing the arising of that quality, the arising of that hindrance, and noticing the non-arising of it, the falling away of that hindrance. So noticing both the arising and the falling away. Same thing with the seven factors of awakening. These are qualities that when in balance, it really cultivates our deepening into our practice. Mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So again, noticing when it's present, when it's not present, and the arising of it, and the falling away of it, the non-arising of it. Now, if we just focus on the difficult, if we just focus on when hindrances are arising, when there's a sense of contraction, whether it's physical, mental, just focusing on the pain, the difficult, we can often become become exhausted from that, because it's just always looking at what's not working. Since a contraction can actually embed into the mindfulness or the tension itself, so we become tighter and tighter around it. The plus side of that, if we are willing to look at the difficulty, the pain, we can see, if we keep stay with it, we can see the emptiness in the middle of that pain, in the middle of that difficulty. So we can actually use the difficult as a cue to turn toward, to actually wake up and see what is present. And if we don't have a relationship to the difficult, we tend to be very much driven by it, trying to escape from it, and we don't even realize that. If we can learn to turn to it, toward it, we can start to bring the release of that identification in the midst of the pain, in the middle of the hindrance. The problem is that if we just focus on the difficult and the pain, it tends to collide with our sense of will, our sense of me having to strive and do something with this, to overcome this part of myself. You know, perhaps this sense of I deserve to punish myself, I deserve to have difficulty. It starts to maybe resonate with our own self dislike, our self-hatred. So when we approach something that's difficult, our self-hatred is kind of this background loading of how we view it. Our sense of self is coming from a place of self-diminishment. We look at what's painful, we contract even more. This also resonates with this natural selection. You know, our ancestors survived more if we reacted to what was dangerous. If we're sitting and we hear something rustle in the bushes and we just kind of ignore it and it turns out to be a tiger, we get eaten. Right? But if we hear it and we run, then our ancestors are able to pass on their genes. And so there's a strong evolutionary bias in our nervous system to notice what's wrong, what's dangerous, what's broken in the environment. The trouble is our environment's usually pretty comfortable. I mean, not for everyone, certainly there's many instances of that. But we turn that internally then. Oh, I'm thinking the wrong thought. I'm sleepy and I shouldn't be. I'm a bad meditator. So that implodes upon ourselves. So that's why the balancing of the awakening factors is very helpful. So you bring a sense of joy, of calmness, tranquility, these kind of cooling factors, a sense of energy, of effort to really look and be curious about what's present, the quality of mindfulness, believing what is here in this moment. So then we have this courage to meet the difficulty with embedded in a sense of lightness, of curiosity. So we need both, and they both ultimately have to be very much integrated in our practice for things to deepen. This actually starts to bring in this sense of non-duality. So non-duality, again, is, as I spoke about last week, is we tend to look out with a sense of separation, this assumed separation of there's me and you. There's a sense of good and wrong, good and bad, like and dislike. It's a natural way we tend to organize the world. This actually creation of separation is one of the main functions of the sense of self. It's one of the main helpful functions is to be able to differentiate. You know, a young child learning to realize, okay, I am not my mother, I'm not my parents, I'm my own person. So it's actually a very healthy thing that we all have to go through. And once we have established a healthy sense of self, then the spiritual practice starts to look at, is that the end of the story? So we tend to start off in the spiritual practice with a very strong preference for form. Okay, what I mean by form is self and other ideas, concepts. We spend much of our life trying to create the right form and get rid of the wrong forms. So this is much of our suffering because that process is always not going to be fully satisfying. It's always going to have a quality of dukkha to it. Because no matter how perfect we get it, that thing is going to change. So we're always chasing with forms. So we start to become realize, okay, form isn't such a good deal. Right? I need to try something different. So we become very enamored with the formless, with a sense of emptiness, with a sense of non-self. Okay, that's really where it's all at. So our practice becomes so focused on that. And we form a very strong preference for formlessness, for non-self. Formless is good, formed is bad. Then we start to see, as our practice deepens, that there's something that holds both of these, holds both form and formless. And this, in the sutta, if you read it from that perspective, you see how that comes forth. That there's this, whatever is arising, notice the arising of it and the passing away, without a preference. You know, he's not saying that, look at this quality as being better to have, and this is being less better to have. And so when we start to come into that, as our practice deepens and matures, then form arises, and it's fine. Form fades, and it's fine. The formless arises and it's fine. The formless fades and it's fine. So this is this first quality, this first sense of how we need to both look at what contracts and also what opens. Right? Often when we do interviews with students, you can sense where they are in that spectrum. Some students are very caught in the contraction, that they're so tight with something. And so learning how to relax is what's needed. Other times they're so open, but they're kind of avoiding the pain that's driving it. They're doing a little bit of a spiritual bypass. So they're saying, okay, look at that deeper rub in there, that discomfort. There's that subtle guidance that helps them see, bring into balance both the contraction and the openness. The second quality is this mechanism of forming a sense of self. So all through the sutta, we've been looking at from that perspective, you know, what deconstructs the sense of self, where is it formed? How is it created? How is it seen through? But in this part of the sutta, the Buddha gets very down, he gets down to brass tacks. Okay, so he actually lays out, this is the mechanism that we form the sense of self. And he gives actually two of the three ones you commonly see. The five aggregates and the six sense bases. There's also the dependent origination, which isn't in this sutta. So this is a much more directly way of looking at how the sense of self arises and fades away. And again, throughout the sutta, though, he says, just notice when form is present and when it's not present. Notice when it arises and when it's not arising. Going back to that non-duality, noticing when the sense of self arises and when it doesn't arise. He's not saying, notice when the sense of self arises and judge yourself. He's not saying, notice when the sense of self is gone and congratulate yourself. He's saying, just notice. He's pointing to this quality of attention, like the space in this room that holds everything completely equally, without a preference. Complete allowance. Because anytime there's a sense of friction, a sense of resistance, the sense of self is arising. It becomes very slippery. So by actually, we learn to Rodney used to say, you have to really learn to love it, what do you say? Love it into its end. It's like you open to it so fully, such a complete acceptance, that there's no problem if the sense of self arises. And that way it's held with something much, much bigger. It's, again, the space in the room, the quiet in the room. Now, five aggregates, I'm not going to go into the details of that because that will be overwhelming for our brains. But think of it simply as how we create a sense of self based on something arises in our experience, and with the mechanism of our memory, our past experiences, our past conditioning, our past actions, all come together to create a sense of self. Aggregates literally means a bundle or a heap of things that we've put together. This is who I am. I think it's helpful whenever you see the word five aggregates, think sense of self. Sense of self, five aggregates are one and the same. Noticing when it arises and when it falls away. Noticing the actual the mechanism of it arising and falling away. The other quality in this, the other set of instructions is around the sense base, sense bases. And this is another way the Buddha explained the sense of self or talked about the mechanism of it arising. And this is more subtle, but it's also a little simpler too. So when we experience something through our sense doors, you know, sight, our normal five that we think about, and also thought, is considered the sixth, number six in the sense doors in Buddhist psychology. So we have a raw sense data, we have an organ that perceives it, and we have a consciousness of consciousness, a sense of, okay, hearing consciousness, seeing consciousness. So these are very subtle qualities. But the part that I think is important to focus on is that also arising with those is what's called a fetter. So when you think of a fetter, like something that ties you down, that you're chained. You know, you can't, you're tied to this. And there's different fetters, but one of the most important ones is the sense of self. Okay, so when a sight arises, we also have a sense of me who's seeing it. When a sound arises, there's a sense of me who's hearing it. So there's this way that we tie the sense of self to that sense door, to that sense experience. In the Bahira Sutta, there's a famous line where he says, just in the hearing, there's just the hearing. In the seeing, there's just the seeing. He's saying, let go of that. That fetter falls away. When that fetter falls away, then there's a moment of awakening. There's a moment of non-self. So this mechanism of forming the sense of self. There's a line that's repeated again and again in this sutta. She lives independent and clings to naught in the world. She lives independent and clings to naught in the world. This really relates to this mechanism of selfing. Living independent. What does living independent mean? It's not like moving away from your parents or not having to work. It's independent is usually we live really dependent upon this mechanism of creating the sense of self. That we're always hearing a sound or a sight, and we create a sense of self to that. We have memories that arise with it, ideas that arise with it. You know, watch your mind. Like when you hear something, hear a song, you smell a smell that has associations with it, and you start to think about those associations. You've created a little mini sense of self. And then something else arises, and then another sense of self arises based on the memories and conditioning with that sense data. So living independently means that we can allow the sense data to arise. We don't have to form around it. We can just simply allow it to arise and be fully experienced. As it passes away, it fully passed away. So by doing this, we start to become much more, you know, on one hand you can think, okay, that means I'm much more disconnected from life. I'm a little aloof from life. Things are arising and they're not affecting me. That's not what this means at all. You're actually much more affected by life because you're not forming a story or relationship to it. It's like you're fully connected to what's arising, like being a very good dance partner, that there's a unity of the movement. Something arises and you're able to rise right with it. And when that stops, then you're on to the next thing, instead of holding that last experience. So clinging to naught. Now clinging to naught. Clinging is really this action that creates this sense of self. The sense of self, it's such a constant for most of us that we're constantly living from that, relating from that. Right? It's kind of like this, the default. So it seems like it's a perpetual motion machine that's always, just keeps going without any input, endlessly recreating the sense of self. Right? In some ways that's true, that we create a sense of self arises, there's a suffering that comes from that, that is the seeds for the next sense of self. And then we connect the dots of all these senses of self to create this picture, like the old connect the dots things we did as children. We're seeing one of those pictures that's a composite. You have these little pictures that when put together in a particular way form this much bigger picture. That much bigger picture is our sense of my life. Now, of course I have a sense of self. You know, I've done this in my life. I had this job. I lost that job. I had this relationship. I lost that relationship. There's this whole idea of continuity, but really we're connecting the dots. We're connecting each piece together. Now, the sense of clinging is the mechanism, the hidden energy that keeps coming into that, to keep reinforcing it. That's why the Buddha talks about she lives independent and clings to naught in the world. So it's not about, again, being removed from life, pushing away from other people. It's this quality of clinging, of being a little sticky with this moment's experience. Because sometimes when the sense of self has fallen away, you can almost feel this kind of dry firing of this clinging. It's like there's this impulse to cling, to stick to something. But in that moment of selflessness, of non-self, there's not nothing, it doesn't make sense. It's like, well, who's going to be clinging? Where's their satisfactoriness in this? It's like the emptiness is seen clearly in that moment. So you feel the impulse to cling, to form, without it making any sense. That impulse is there so much of the time. But as our practice deepens, it starts to fall away in many areas. This fetter starts to loosen. So this is the second category that I lump together, the sense of aggregates and sense data, how we take those together to make a sense of self. Again, just noticing it as it arises and as it falls away. Now the final category is the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths. So we talk about it as this list or this kind of conceptual overview we put on our practice. But in this sutta, the Buddha talks about seeing it directly in this moment's experience, seeing how it really is arising in this moment, the direct knowing of that. You know, in this moment, this is suffering as it has come to be. This is the origin of it, of suffering, as it has come to be. This is a sensation of suffering as it's come to be. This is the path to the end of that suffering. So this conceptual is a conceptual overlay that we bring from the Dharma. But because we've spent so much time learning to relate to experience very simply, very directly, and seeing loosening this quality of preference, wisdom's grown. And from this quality of wisdom, then we can overlay this idea of this is where it creates suffering. We recognize when the self arises, that's an origin of suffering. When the self falls away, that's a cessation of suffering. When I'm in the middle of a sense of self, that is a quality of suffering. So we start to recognize that. And by recognizing, we start to see the roadmap. Okay, this is how this fits in. I was talking to a friend the other day about my practice. Most of my practice has been very experiential. You know, the way Rodney unfolded it for me was we're very much going on retreats and practicing in daily life and using investigation to see how the sense of self arises. And I probably went 10 years, 15 years without even read any suttas or any books. And then when I started to read a book, it's like, oh, you know, I can see through my own experience, the words really came to life. So not saying one way is better than another, but for me, it was very, very helpful to have my practice grounded experientially. So as I opened to things like the sutta, like the Satipatthana Sutta, it really became, I could see how my experience informed my understanding of it. So this sutta is very much concerned with this very moment's arising, this very moment of contraction or opening. Yeah, what is arising can be held completely without any sense of friction or resistance. As we do that, we sometimes say, well, what about, how do I be in this world without its injustice, all its difficulty, my own life? Does this mean I can't do anything? Am I just this kind of doormat, or am I this sense of being very helpless? Should I just retreat into a cave and let the world kind of take care of itself? In some ways, you could say yes, that you do nothing as the practice deepens, that you don't do anything. It's not the same as nothing being done. So it asks us to really step out of our normal way of assuming, our normal way of being in the world. The normal way is very much embedded in the sense of self, that I have to go do something. As the sense of self starts to loosen and deconstruct, and we see it as just what it is, just something that's manufactured, and something else has to come forth to move us through life, to move us into action, into standing up for people's rights, to helping right justice. It's a very different mechanism that's hard to see from the side of a sense of self. It makes absolutely no sense. And that sense of paradox actually is very helpful, because that sense of, okay, I just don't understand it, means that the perspective that you're viewing it from can't solve that problem. But when the perspective is shifted, then the problem makes complete sense. Just to end as a guide for that, Narasagadatta was a very famous Indian sage who actually Rodney was able to study with. When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. And between these two, my life turns. Just sit quietly for a moment or two. When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. And between these two, my life turns. Just in this moment, what is arising? Allowing to be held by the spaciousness, by the stillness which is not of you. It's not created by you. The stillness holds you itself. Thank you for your attention. So we have a chance for some questions or comments. Yes, Iris.
Any thoughts on why Buddha used those Dharma concepts versus some other ones like origination?
So the question is, what, any sense of why the Buddha used those five things instead of other Dharma concepts? You know, I think we have to be careful when we say, you know, why did the Buddha do this or not? Because if you look at the sutta, I mean, this is way too much to get, there's too much detail to be given at one sitting, the way the sutta is set up. And so I think most scholars look at it and see that it's really, things have been added, it's kind of fleshed out. So I can see they say, well, this puts some good stuff into this foundation. That decision was probably made after the Buddha had passed away, probably many, many years after the Buddha passed away. You know, so just not to say, why did the Buddha decide to do that? Some scholars actually say that fourth foundation probably just had two elements, had the hindrances and had the awakening factors. You know, so, but you know, that is not to say to throw it out. It's still very helpful to look at it, and you know, especially look at, okay, how the sense of self, there's really two that forms around the sense of self, aggregates and sense data and sense spaces. And then the contraction of the hindrances and the opening, the bright energy of the awakening factors. And the four foundations bring this, the sense of this is why we practice. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And I guess
to be able
Yeah, that's a good question. So the comment is concerned about getting caught up in the concepts or the ideas or trying to figure out what's going, where am I on the map in this moment, and you know, sensing that. So you can see how there's the wisdom in that that comes through your practice, is that you realize that could be a pitfall to say, okay, I have to figure out exactly where I am on this huge map, right? And so that in itself, you recognize that, okay, that's a moment of contraction. So I would take it very simply. You know, I always default, if you have a choice, default to the simpler way of relating to experience. You know, so much of the practice is learning how simply to open to it so fully, so completely, without absolutely no friction, no resistance to this moment's experience. And as that just deepens and deepens in you. And then, you know, sometimes you might feel, oh, here's a contraction. It's like, but for myself, just holding that opening, sometimes I feel this contraction. Oh, this is a sense of clinging. So just having a very light conceptual idea going to help me deepen more into it, but it almost arose spontaneously. Another way you can have, if there's something that you found interesting, like I'm really interested in the, you know, the seven factors. So pick out one of the factors and just kind of sit with that. Okay, where is there investigation in this moment? You know, how is that showing up? What's investigation? Or what is clinging? And so like you're holding it as a koan, that you just keep holding that question and allowing it to start to reveal itself. I think that's much more helpful than trying to map your moment-by-moment experience. And that's why I think this fourth foundation is, in some ways, is my least favorite, because there's a tendency to get so caught up in the intellect and the ideas around it. You're welcome. Yeah, Moffat. Yeah. Okay, so the comment is, part of the question is the present moment really just kind of dull compared to what our thoughts in the future, what, you know, what we think of in the future, and how the sense of self is why is it sort of so much momentum into the future versus connecting to the present moment? Is that, I think often, and I've certainly experienced that myself personally, that, okay, there's so much allure into this fantasy or this idea of what I hope to become, or I want to gain, or want to understand, or, you know, like, your classic is when you get in a relationship for the first time, there's a sense of really a lot of interest. It's just like, okay, I can't wait till the next time I talk to the person. Until, you know, you talk to them and you have a fight, and then it's like, but there's this leaning into the moment. You know, how that feels. And I think what often happens is we're not paying attention quite closely enough. So if you can start to release, the trick is just try to release the object of what you're focusing on and really go into the generic quality of wanting, of leaning, of desire. And then you start, when you start to be able to do that, and it's a little tricky because we're so conditioned to, I want that, I'm going to get it, and then I'll be happy. Everything else doesn't matter. So I have to be willing to set aside that actually getting that, the impulse, all the actions that are generated to get that thing, that person, whatever it might be, and come into the actual experience of wanting it. When you start to become attuned to that, you start to realize that actually wanting is unpleasant. It actually is painful to want. So this is, it's a direct seeing. So it's like, because there's such a strong allure, we don't see the actual moment of discomfort, of pain in this moment, how hard it is to be wanting something other than this moment. So that's the contraction side. The other side of it is noticing when that's absent, when there's a sense of just simply being, you know, like sitting and watching your children and just, you know, things are mellow and no one's fighting. Everyone's just like, you know, it's really nice just to be here with these people that I love. And you just open to that sense of simply being here. Nothing needs to be changed in this moment. And you really take in how that feels. Right, so then you start to notice, okay, this movement away from this moment is a movement into selfing. It's, you know, don't worry about being the selfing, but just notice it very experientially, how it creates a contraction, how it's painful. Now this opening to this moment, even when it seems dull, when it seems boring, and there's a very deep satisfaction. You start to trust that more and more. Now, it's not going to be like you can just do it, that often when you try to connect with the moment, the hindrances arise. There's all this is boring, this is not interesting, I'm feeling restless. And so it takes a while to really learn to really meet that experience, even if it's difficult. But as we do that more and more, we start to discharge the reactivity that we live with. It's like there's a static charge that we've built up, and it hurts when we let go of it. But it's discharged. And then we start to have this more access to this piece of the moment. Thank you. Yes. Okay, so the question is, when, like for example, with thought, when a thought arises and we turn our attention to it, often just turning toward it, it pops. And where does investigation fit in? Because investigation can feel or seem a little dangerous. That can be like getting into, going into a car, going down a path, a stream of thought. And we realize that's actually going against what we thought meditation was all about. So when do we use meditation? How do we use it? When do we just notice it with bare attention? When do we bring investigation? Is that okay? I think it's almost like a kind of a, we have to first learn to have, well, I don't know if you can even say that. I was going to say that we first have to learn to have this bare attention, this willingness to just meet things just as they are. I was hesitating because there's also could be a lot said for just having the sense of curiosity, which is really investigation. This willingness to just really make, what is this really, this sense of pain that I've been living with, what does it really feel like in this moment? And for me, I think it's very helpful to look at investigation as like a cake with one part thought and four parts body sense. Okay, so as I'm investigating, let's say I have a physical pain, or let's say, to use your example, I have a thought that arises. It keeps a recurrent thought. okay, I'm really nervous about something that's going to happen next week. So if I go into the thought and I start to mull it over and I start to add more and more elaboration, and like a rumination, okay, then we've kind of shifted out of investigation. But if I'm able to come hold up this idea, this sense of this thing in the future, or this thought that has a lot of charge, and in the moment, at the same time, tune into how it feels in the body. You know, the tense of contraction, really specifically, where do you feel the contraction in the body? Where do you feel the sensations in the body, the emotions connected with that? Then you're investigating, but at the same time, you're really connected with your present moment experience. I think that way it starts to, it's almost like you're going through different layers of a cavern. That you open to this one cavern and you're staying connected to your body, feeling the breeze, sensing the darkness, you're shining your light around. And once you've really connected to the felt experience of that, okay, maybe there's a different thought, a deeper thought that arises with that. Okay, there's this fear of something happening. Oh, there's this deeper fear. Or maybe there's anger that I connect with it. And then at the same, like down that level, I feel all these qualities of the body, the sense of physicality in that moment. And that helps us stay connected with it. So it's really having that, because you ask the question, you know when you start to get lost in thought, versus using thought as, it's like the investigation is almost like having a flashlight. Where you decide to shine that light is the quality of investigation. I want to look at this part, all right? But when it gets lost in rumination, we're kind of going, it's taking charge versus, okay, I'm going to hold it. So it's like you keep holding that question. Does that help?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for that question. What else? Yes.
Yeah, you spoke for a moment about a period of time in your life where you spent a lot of time just contemplating what was coming up in your life from day to day as you were going through life and not just practice. But it wasn't so much embedded in suttas and
knowledge. Yes.
As being sort of the thing that sort of helps me sort out a lot of anxiety, worry, issues that arise for me in my day-to-day living. And sometimes when I'm hearing the teachings, when they have 27 parts and 8 layers, that it's like information overload.
Right.
And my mind just kind of floods and I kind of get... I don't know. It's off-putting in a way.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there are just different times for different aspects of it. And the question about sort of, Iris's question about the likeness of sort of picking up some of these things and sometimes
yes.
Ruminating with them. I wonder if you could comment more on that.
Sure. Okay. Yes, the question is about this sense of being really embodied in our practice, really noticing the moment by moment arising has been very helpful. And sometimes when you hear all the myriad of lists, it feels like it's overload and it's like takes you away. And just the deep understanding that connecting to the present moment has been very helpful, helping you untie and understand you know, patterns of anxiety or worry or whatever it might be. And is there a way to bring in kind of the richness of the suttas and all the lists in a way that's manageable, that allows you to keep that centeredness in the body but not being lost? Is that? Yeah, so it's an excellent question. And what I would tend to say is just, you know, do a little bit at a time. And each person has a certain tendency. Some people may really love to go into the suttas, and that's perfectly fine. What I would say is one of the downsides of purely experiential practice, I'll explain it in the way the Buddha talked about it, is that if you had an elephant in the room, and let's say we all had lost our sight, and you came up to one part of the elephant and you grabbed a hold of the tail. Okay, that's coming into your own experience. You're like, okay, I really know what my experience is like. The trouble is when you extrapolate and say that tail is the entirety of the elephant, when you haven't gone around to touch these other parts. So sutta study, you know, listening to teachers, start to help you see there's a bigger landscape that the tail is attached to. So it's integral to the landscape, but it's not the entirety of it. So like, for example, you talked about noticing, coming into your moment's experience when you're having an emotion, and that's been very helpful. So as long as we start to come into this bigger overlay of why do we do that? Do we do it just to help us get through that emotion? Or do we do it to start to deeply understand the sense of self? How the sense of self really forms around that. And then we start to, when anxiety arises or worry comes up, we're able to really tune into that felt sense, but we're also noticing, this is how I form the sense of self. Right? And so by kind of inclining your attention through being informed by the teachings, it helps you see more clearly how things fit together. And that way you start to deepen into that moment. And it starts to translate more and more to the different aspects of your life. So instead of being this way we might just try to fix things or try to make things more comfortable, we see, if I understand the sense of self, that really, it's like the root of a lot of things. You see, it's the root of everything. Right? By not having the bigger context, you may not really look at it in that way. So I would do it that way. Just one part that really stands forth. So with Rodney and my years with him, non-self is something he keeps coming back to again and again. So as a student, I focused on that, and so that became a very simple lens, a simple handle to look at everything through. And that's what I try to do with the sutta. Is to one, respect all the details of it. But at the same time, trying to make it more accessible through the one lens of non-self and deconstruction. Yeah, so just read a little bit of a sutta, and I'm really curious on it. Just sit with that. You can sit with one line, like, what is that one? She clings to nothing. I can't find it, but you find a line that really resonates and work with that way. Okay, thank you. Yes. Yeah. And I just also a couple words in there. So you talked about choiceless awareness as opposed to controlling it, or is it? Well, it's a good question. So the question is about, often the suttas, there's a sense of really cultivation that you try to gladden the mind or try to, use wise effort to get these good qualities and get rid of these bad qualities. And how is that contrasted with more of a sense of open, choiceless awareness or open awareness, that you're just allowing things to rise completely without any kind of preference? Well, it's really in this broader tradition, there's these two camps, there's multiple camps. And so if it resonates with you to have that sense of really focusing on something and trying to cultivate it, that's perfectly fine. Really from Rodney's heritage or his tradition and what I've learned through my practice with him and my own practice, is the choice awareness is really my bias. That's really what I tend to open toward. Because it's worked for me, and there's a way that trying to do something, eventually you have to fail in that. You have to realize, okay, I have to let go. And that's one of the, the beautiful paradoxes. You see this often in the Zen tradition, that you kind of set up to fail. Okay, you know, try really, really hard, try more hard, and then eventually you let go completely of trying, and something else arises from that. But unless you had tried, the releasing wouldn't have happened. The trouble is sometimes people crash and burn from trying so hard. So it's kind of seeing where is your temperament, you know, where is that? But, you know, from my own experience, I can only really speak toward the choiceless awareness. I haven't done very many practices just to cultivate gladness, things like that. That being said, sometimes people have it's very helpful to, like, if there's so much self-hatred or so much fear, cultivating something like loving kindness can be very helpful. So, you know, just like the question about with the elephant, is like, okay, this really works for me. But also be aware that sometimes there's other sides that may be very helpful. So just kind of keep it an open question, but follow what resonates with you. All right, thank you. All right, thank you for your kind and attentive questions. And we have a few announcements.